Hey everybody, I'm going to break in really quick just to say that while we are in quarantine, a lot of us are trapped inside with our small brothers and sisters as well as barking dogs. So you'll have to keep that in mind when you hear Oleg Zadio, because there is a bit of background noise, but he is an exceptionally interesting kid. So please forgive that and be prepared to have an interesting listen. Thanks everybody. Hey everybody, this is Greg with another Greg Talks. This is number 12. Just as a precursor, remember this is a companion podcast to the Brothers Wisp, so this is a very informal mix of technical and non-technical material, so proceed with caution. Today we have Oleg.
Hi.
That's all we get is just a hi.
Excellent. Hi.
Excellent. So I don't know if you guys can tell, but Oleg is, how old are you? 11? Is that right?
No, I am 17.
I know, I was giving you a hard time. So you're 17-year-old, you're from Texas, and you are a programmer, no?
Yes, I am a programmer. I am proficient with Python and learning C++ as we speak.
Excellent. So you live in Texas, you're a fellow Texan, but you're not originally from Texas, right?
Yeah, I'm originally from Ukraine. I moved to the United States, well, I got adopted at 10, so majority of my life was spent in Ukraine, and then I came to the United States.
Okay. Was that a pretty big culture shock for you, or what? What's the story?
Yeah, it was a big change. It's been, like, not only did I have to relearn essentially a new language and how to read and write and communicate, but the cultures are very, very different in terms of how people treat each other and what people say and what people don't say. It's the latter that is giving me issues, not the former.
Really? So whenever you came over here, what was your English like?
Hi, do you speak English? That's it. Well, the first time I came here was during the summer when my family decided to apply for this hosting program, and they hosted me for 2 months, and that was what I just described with my English state. When I came off the airplane for the very first time, hi, and do you speak English were probably the only two phrases that I knew, or the majority of my vocab.
That's crazy. Well, it sounds like you've come a long way in 7 years.
Oh, yeah. I honestly can't believe how far I made it.
So I've always figured that the hardest part of learning a new language is probably the colloquialisms, the fun things we say. Is that true? Because some of the stuff you say can be kind of bizarre, right? When you take it out of context.
Yeah. So when we started school in April, I came home in February, and I think we started public school in April or so. The fifth grade English class was learning idioms. So I could barely speak normally, let alone parse idioms. So things like dog tired and early bird were look of news to me. And so when I would come home from school, my parents would ask me, how was your day? And are you tired? I was like, I'm two dogs tired, but just one. I'm two dogs tired.
Two dogs tired. That's hilarious, yeah. Man. Also culturally the way people treat each other and stuff. So what were you getting at there? What was different about that?
I believe personally that in Europe, people tend to shoot more straight, if you will. They tend to speak the truth rather than cover it up. Well, it wasn't good, but here's what you can do better. They're just going to go it was bad.
You know what? I've heard that. I've heard that from a lot of my European friends, as they say that Americans are disingenuous. You can't exactly take what they say at face value is what they tend to say.
It's a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think, but if you look at America geography wise, we're so big that we really are different countries depending on where you happen to be, in the US. And so down here in Texas, we try and we try and save everybody's feelings, you know. So it's like, oh, honey, you know, and then, oh, you know, yeah. I wasn't sure. Whereas I think I know some folks from like New York, and they're very blunt about how they think and feel. So maybe that would be more more akin to what you're used to.
Yeah, I can't say that I've been prolonged. I have had a prolonged exposure to New York. I mean, but I've been there a couple of times. We primarily flew through them, through the city while going back home.
Gotcha. So you got over here when you were 10-ish. Now you're 17-ish. Yep. At some point, yep. You decided you were going to learn to program. What's the evolution of that?
So I was listening to a podcast actually made by a 13-year-old, and he was like playing games, and essentially he was the inspiration to my programming, because at some point he had dropped that he was building something, and I partially learned coding because, you know, computers are cool, but also partially out of spite. Because, like, if he can do it, I can too.
Because he's just some 13-year-old kid. So what, how old were you at this time?
Well, I started looking into that around maybe 12. I was around his age, I can tell you that much.
Okay.
And actually, I didn't get into Python until about 2 years ago. So my starting to code, like looking at code, obviously I'm visually impaired, and some people created the language specifically designed to build like applications that only use audio and speech output. So I looked at that, and the language that they created for that those applications was called BGT. And BGT is equivalent to like block coding, Scratch. It gives you everything out of the box. You don't need to look up anything. There's a like nice reference right there. Everything is like nice and clean. You know what I mean?
So you mentioned Scratch there, and that's kind of the visual programming language, right? Where you take blocks of code and you kind of drag and drop them in place to do your mm-hmm. loops and stuff like that. And you said BGT is akin to that.
It is akin to that, but not quite. Like, you still type code.
Okay.
What I meant by like Scratch gives you everything out of the box. You don't have to go look for anything, right? Like when you, let's say when, if you try to build a game application with C++, you're going to need external libraries.
Mm-hmm.
So with BGT, it's not the case. It comes with everything nicely packaged together, everything pre-installed, nothing can be added, nothing can be removed. And it's already there, like out of the box, ready to create stuff. So you still type code, but you don't have to like seek for external dependencies, which makes it starting out easier.
Interesting. So, I mean, how powerful is this? I mean, what did people generally do with it?
I mean, there is a multiplayer game that hosts about 110 players created in BGT.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So something else you just kind of glossed over, as you said, obviously I'm visually impaired. Nobody listening to this has any idea that you're visually impaired. So that's something that really interests me as well. So it's I come from a computer science background, right? I did that in college. I did all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I obviously could look at my code and, you know, do all of those things. So how is that different for somebody approaching it from the visually impaired? And what does that mean, visually impaired, for you?
So visually impaired means I cannot see at all. I have fake eyes. And I mean, that's what visually impaired is. Now, the way I use my computer is I have a screen reader on it. Can you hear my?
Yeah.
So that's, it constantly talks to me at an extremely fast rate.
How can you understand what it's saying? Like, that was like bananas fast.
It's a lot of practice, and it's not as fast as it can go, and as fast as I can process it. But this is like my comfortable, my comfortable speed. like this is what I parse on a daily basis. A lot of it comes with exposure, where I came from to the United States. Everybody used their phones. My phone talks too. Hello, talk. Can you hear it?
Yeah, yeah, I can hear it. It's like crazy fast as well.
Yes. So everybody in Ukraine, everybody who had technology used the voice on the technology around the same tempo and speed, and that's how you just learn to process it.
So if you're accustomed to hearing your computer talk to you that fast, does it drive you crazy as slow as normal people talk to you?
No. The only time it would drive me crazy is if somebody is like giving a lecture and I'm not being able to interact in any way. That's when I experience like time slowing down and it becomes really, really like very dragging.
I noticed that I've been in some training here lately, and it's like the sales training stuff, and it has not a whole lot to do with the job I'm about to perform. And I keep like wanting to set it to 2x speed. Like it drives me crazy mm-hmm. listening to this stuff. It's like I can take this information in so fast, but it's like I'm forced. I'm on rails. I can't do anything about it. And I just sit there and kind of go bananas in my head because I know I've got like an hour of this ahead of me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of where
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I can't interact, if I can't like ask clarifications or just do anything while they like do anything engaging with the same activity, I'm gonna go crazy.
You're just tied to your chair and you can't do anything about it.
Yep.
That's crazy. So you've got a screen reader. So how does that tie into programming? Obviously so you said you mostly do Python. Are you doing that in a development environment or you just do it in a text file or what?
So with Python it's a special case where I don't use an editor necessarily. I just use my good old Notepad and Google. So you know how Python works with indentions and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My screen reader has the ability to report as I scroll through the lines, how many tabs or spaces are present, like at the start of it. And it does so automatically. Wow. Like it just says one tab and then like def, whatever. Oh, sorry.
No worries, man.
It says like one tab and then it continues to read the line, two tab, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, that's what it is. It just reads. I can read code line by line. I use a plain old Notepad, and I use the command line to compile my code. So very old style.
Yeah, as you say, it sounds very old school. But you know what? I took for granted that everybody knows how Python works. So explain the indentions and why that's so important in Python.
So indentation in Python is akin to curly braces, which means it helps you separate logic. And it tells the compiler what statements are part of the log, like the block that you're currently typing. So if you're doing an if statement, you may want to indent the next couple of statements to tell the compiler that, hey, if this is true or if this if statement triggers, then you're going to execute all the statements with the same indentions following it. Most other languages use braces for it,
mm-hmm.
Or curly brackets. Most of C languages, I think Ruby is the happy exception. But
yeah, I've noticed. So I remember the first time I've done just the tiniest bit of Python scripting in the past, and I remember the first time that was driving me bananas, the indentation thing, because it was just so different than what I was accustomed to. Like you said, I'm very used to braces or some structure in that fashion. I've always done indentation. I think every good programmer does to some degree mm-hmm. or another, but I wasn't like forced into a box by it. But here recently I've started using Ansible, which is an automation platform, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of maintained by Red Hat, and mm-hmm. They use YAML files. And Ansible itself is written in Python, but the YAML files are also very structured, just like Python. And so my brain is kind of rewiring itself to get accustomed to that stuff. And I actually like it. I've come over to the dark side, I guess.
Yeah, that's a lot of people. A lot of people really dislike Python precisely because of its indentation. I think it's just another thing to get used to. Like I can toggle braces to indentation in blink of an eye, and I kind of have someone working with CVP and Python at the same time. And also with C++, I know that there is Microsoft Visual Studio, and I have it, but I still use the command line for a multitude of reasons. Like when in doubt, I always prefer Notepad and a command line compiler because I can't guarantee that the editor will work. Hmm. And I also believe that by almost having that autocomplete and, you know, that pretty syntax highlighting, you're reducing the amount of learning you could do for the language. Because you don't have to memorize the function names, or you just have to memorize the first three, I don't know, letters, and then just click on your options. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I 100% know what you mean, and I think you're insane, because my old man brain can only hold so much information. As I push something new in, something else falls out the back. So I definitely need the autocompletes, and I need to hit F1 and have it prompt me for some stuff. I need as much help as I can possibly get. But I totally get what you're saying. So with this Ansible stuff that I'm learning right now, I'm forcing myself to not copy and paste. I'm forcing myself to type every word, every line, every space. So I'm not necessarily using tabs. I'm just using a couple of spaces in the YAML stuff. So I'm forcing myself to do that, you know, because for me, a lot of it's, I learn in two ways. One is via repetition, do it over and over. And then one is do it wrong a whole bunch of different ways until I get so upset that I finally find the right way and it sort of sticks. I don't know. Those are really the two ways. So that's working well for me. But once I get to a certain level of mastery, and it's different for everything, you know, I kind of then will let myself find the more efficient route. But I guess for you, really, the most consistent way of doing it is going to be Notepad always. And that's still usable in like a team environment. So I was thinking, like, you know, if everybody's developing in, like you said, C, and you're doing it in Visual Studio, you can still just share your docs over to somebody else that can pull it in their IDE and work on it.
It's not that I can't use Visual Studio. It's clunky, meaning that the key presses that I hit sometimes don't register, and sometimes it misses it. I don't know why. Other people have that problem as well, like NVDA, which is my screen reader. I have not heard about JAWS, which is another screen reader that you could use, but it costs. But something that I can't use Visual Studio is, ironically, I'm faster without it.
Right. Because you developed your workflow this whole time using just Notepad. So that's, you know what? I've been using Windows since 1995, I think. And so that's, ooh, I've developed my workflow in Windows that whole time, right? And so I've been building muscle memory just for a bajillion years, longer than you've been alive. And so now at Red Hat, they want me to use a Mac. And everything is wrong. Everything is in the wrong place. Wrong. Right, it's like my workflow. So, like in Google, I can hit Control T and it opens up a new tab. In Mac, it's this Command button in T, and it's Command C and Command V for copy and paste. It's not Control anymore, and the keys are all in the wrong place. There's no Home key or End key. There's no page up, no page down. I'm going bananas, bud.
I don't like Mac.
But
I love it.
I'm forcing myself into it, right? You know, like you said, you know, you can learn anything new if you force yourself to do it. But
yeah, I love their command line, like their terminal. Mm-hmm. It's very intuitive. You can get information about anything, and like any command that you want. But I hate their like GUI, graphical user interface. I can't.
Is it just because you've developed so much muscle memory for Windows, or what?
I generally believe they have a screen reader on a Mac. It's a VoiceOver. I believe you can turn it on with Command F5. But it's very, very unintuitive. like it brings in a whole layer of commands that you don't need to have. It basically reinvents the wheel and makes the keys function differently from their original purpose, and it makes it just basically adds a whole new layer to the computer.
I get what you're saying about the terminal. I really like that. By the way, that's command spacebar, and you could get this search window that you could just type terminal. Having to learn all these new things is driving me crazy. Anyway, I love it because it really is just a Linux terminal. So
yes,
you've got all the power in front of you. Although Windows 10 now, I think in certain versions, you can pull up
a Linux terminal. You can install WSL. Yep.
So, you know, they're starting to get parity a little bit. I don't know.
They should merge the Linux terminal with the Windows machine.
They might as well.
I'll be happy. Yeah.
I don't think there's too many people that are banging around in the command prompt anymore, are there?
I mean, if you want to do like port monitoring and stuff, you have to use nmap, which is purely command based, I believe.
So if you're programming, what are you banging around with nmap for?
Primarily to see, I use it once to see when I built a network server, I wanted to see if my packets were encrypted or not. And I needed to figure out if my traffic was coming through, servers behaving weirdly. I mean, that's pretty much really the only thing I used it for. I'm currently in an introduction to cybersecurity class.
What do you think about it? So you've started doing programming. It sounds to me like you're going to be in computers one way or the other. Like,
oh yeah,
that's your trajectory. Cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't see that going away anytime soon. It seems like people are always hiring for cybersecurity experts. All the marketing stuff I see is for cybersecurity stuff. Is that, do you think that's where you're eventually going to go?
I mean, I would like to at least investigate it. Because you're right, the market is wanting a lot of cybersecurity, and I believe that I can I have the skills for it. But I also I really enjoy the puzzles that is programming every day, like the huge puzzle that you get to put together when you create a project. So I may want to do like software developing or something like that.
Yeah, I mean you're solving problems in creative ways when you're programming. I like that.
Yeah,
because there's always 100 ways you can accomplish the same task, right?
There's always 100 ways, but not a lot of them are correct, unfortunately.
That's right, or they're just not very efficient.
Yeah,
or they're not reusable.
That's my problem right now. Is like I can code. I need to learn to code with efficiency.
Well, what I learned a long time ago is that computers are ever increasing in their power, which allows me to be even sloppier with my code, so I don't have to it kind of compensates for me sometimes.
See, I think that's kind of bad. I believe that we should be restricted a little bit more as to how much our programs can access, so we actually worry.
And that's why I'm not a full-time programmer. I've always been a get it done kind of guy. It never looks pretty, but it accomplishes the task. If I could put duct tape on it, I'm probably going to do that.
I mean, the duct tape works. Why, why reinvent the wheel?
I know, right? All right, so cybersecurity, what's interesting about that that kind of pulls you in?
It's a lot of logic and a lot of consideration, like what is the weakness here and how it's all working together. We did Cyber Patriot, which is a cybersecurity competition. Essentially, you have multiple computers that you need to secure. They come with some vulnerabilities on them. You don't know what the vulnerabilities are. You just need to go fix them. And some of them are like changing the password on the user's account because it's not secure, or removing unauthorized accounts. Some of them are a little more hidden, like make sure that all the right like firewall settings are enabled, and you have about 8 hours to do it. And so I really enjoyed that portion of the class because of the amount of thinking you had to do. I generally like myself to be mentally challenged, not in a stupid way, just in general.
No, I totally get you. I have to be mentally stimulated or I get bored too fast. Like, mm-hmm. I don't like going to the beach. Like, stuff like that doesn't really do, like, my kids, my little, well, they're, God, Lee, they're not little anymore. They're 11 and 14, and my 14-year-old, so I'm 6'3", and my 14-year-old's like 6'2.5". So oof. He's definitely, and he's like 210 pounds, so he's definitely not little anymore. And he certainly doesn't sound little. He sounds like an 11-year-old version of him trying to do an impression of what an adult sounds like. His voice is getting deeper, but it's sort of in this weird spot. Anyway, I digress. Yeah, like when they were little, we'd go to the beach and I could tolerate that for a day. And then after that, I'm going crazy just because there's nothing to, like, you know, challenge your brain in there. And I said, that's the stuff that really gets me going, is I like to think out of the box. I like hypotheticals, like somebody comes to you with a problem. How would you approach this and that and that and that? And then you have all these various external inputs. And I mean, I love that stuff. That's what fascinates me the most.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way, at least on that front. I also don't like going to the beach for an extended period of time. We went to the beach, I think, this summer. Yeah. And yeah,
you just get bored.
Yeah, I get bored, and it's messy at some point. Like, you just come in and there's only so many times to clean the sand out of your stuff and think that it's fun.
And it gets everywhere, literally everywhere. Sand is the worst. And my wife loves the beach. She's like, I would love to live there one day. And it's like, oh, I hope you and your new husband will have a great time. That'll be terrific. Oh, no, it is. Yeah, it's the absolute worst. But so what do you do to challenge yourself mentally? How do you stimulate yourself?
Well, right now I'm learning C++, which coming from Python, totally different story. Not because of the syntax. Actually, the syntax is the easy part for me. But the way you think and the way you operate, because Python is so nice, it allows you to do nasty, nasty, nasty things. What's it called? It has a recursion limit, which basically means that there's only so many times you can call the same function, and it allows you to change that at whim or go past it and crash the entire program. That's what I mean by nasty things. So like I said, a lot of my mental challenges come from learning CPP, at least right now. I also do my best to read. Right now I'm reading more about cryptography, because that's something else that I want to go into.
Really? What is it? Yes. What is it about cryptography that interests you? Is it just the challenge?
That, and I've always been interested in maintaining my privacy. So I want to make sure that whatever I have or whatever I'm using is valid and secure. And obviously, I can't do that without knowing crypto.
So where does that need for privacy or anonymity, where does that come from?
I didn't have a lot of privacy when I was growing up, and so I think that some of that need comes, like, stems from that, and some of it also is, you know, me being a teen wanting some space. So
so you're trying to say your parents smother you a little bit? Is that where you're getting it?
I mean, right now we're all stuck inside the same house. We don't have a chance to, like, get away from each other, really.
Oh yeah, like, at all. I definitely know the feeling right now. Although, like I said, my kids are halfway grown at this point, it feels like, so they don't want anything to do with me, so I kind of let them live their own life.
Yeah. That's kind of my parents. I mean, they're not, like, smothering me. It's just their presence. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're 17, and you're reaching that point where you're starting to want a little bit more freedom, a little bit more autonomy. I get it. Everybody's been there. I say everybody. I know some people that still live with their parents, so maybe not everybody gets there, but
most people.
Yeah, I think most folks do at some point or another.
I can't imagine. Not that I don't love my parents, but yeah, like I just can't imagine living with them for the rest of my life.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, man. That's the natural progression of things. Pants getting wild in there. All right. So you said stuck in quarantine, things are getting wild. How are you distracting yourself other than C++ and crypto? You know what I mean? Like what are some non-technical things you're doing?
I love reading. I can't say that I like it because I would do it way too much to just like it. Right now I'm reading The Dresden Files. And
that was a great series.
Dresden Files is amazing.
Yeah.
For all the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Are you doing the audiobook versions or are you doing like a screen reader?
No, audiobook versions. Yeah. Screen reader versions are typically bad.
Yeah. I do audiobooks. I don't actually read myself. So I would just, when I was like going... driving to work, or if I was going for a run, or if I'm in the shower, I would just listen to audiobooks. Now I've switched to podcasts. That's all I listen to anymore now. But I thought the narrator on the Dresden Files was awesome. It was a lot of fun. It kind of, Harry would break my heart because he just, no matter what happens, he always loses. Even when he wins, he finds a way to lose. And it kills me.
Yeah. Poor Harry Dresden. Another thing that I just finished reading is The Shining.
Oh, that was good. That was really good.
That was good, and I'm waiting for somebody. I read The Shining with a person, and we decided to have a chat about it. Well, she hasn't finished reading it. It's been 3 weeks since.
Are you gonna go to Dr. Sleep next?
We probably are, probably not, because Shining really, really. It's really heavy, like mentally, because if you think about the implications the author places, it is really, really scary. It's not the content in the book that is scary; it's the psychological stuff.
Does it feel a little too close to home right now?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody trapped inside. Everybody's trapped in the lodge.
Well, it felt, without going too much into details, it felt like some of the remnants of my life that I left behind.
Oh, I gotcha. So it just hit too close to home for sure then.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we will go to Dr. Sleep. Not because it's not going to be a good book, because I'm not sure if I can handle more strikes at my fragile base.
That fragile teenage self-image, I get it. I thought Dr. Sleep was actually better than The Shining. I really did. I thought it was really good. Are you a Stephen King fan in general?
No, this was an introduction to Stephen King, so we started off with a bang, and actually I decided to read Stephen King because I asked somebody an interesting question, and I was like, what if COVID-19 was the nature's way of limiting population because it knows that it can't sustain much more than what it already has. And so they said that, well, if it was the case, then we would be going into Stephen King territory. And so I was like, what do you mean? They're like, you should read the some of his books and make a, you know, the definition for yourself, because it's a little different for everybody.
Yeah.
And so that's why I decided to read The Shining and dragged somebody else into it.
So what's your normal flavor of book that you go for?
I bounce between fiction, sci-fi, historical fiction lately, or even like real. Like I enjoy reading real history books, or books that sort of are tending to stories but are still true. The life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer is a good example of that. It was a drama that was produced about a real character, so I really enjoy books about that. But yeah, sci-fi, fiction, history, lit RPG sometimes.
Interesting.
Which is a book in a style of like you're playing a game but you're still reading a book. So you have like stats and you have experience, loot levels, etc. Some of them are really, really fun actually.
That's cool. So did you ever read Ready Player One?
Oh yes.
What did you think about that?
Yeah, I read. So I liked it and I sat down and I examined it and then half the book is office philosophy. And or like half the book is just the main character moping about himself and how he's not good enough, which I guess is, you know, it serves as a sort of like an arc for him to like get his act together and, you know, go do the right thing. I don't know. I never enjoy self-centered books where the characters just like drone on and on and on about how they're wondering about their philosophy and how the philosophy is wrong and how it may be right and. Yeah, you get the point.
Yeah. I think my takeaway from it was, you know, it's like your classic teenage angst, you know, where they're sort of confused about their place in the world. And, you know, they have all these emotions, all these feelings. They don't know what to do with them. They like this girl. Maybe she doesn't like me back. You know, it's just kind of the whole evolution of all that stuff.
See, yeah, I'm just never... Like, we get too much of that in real life, so when the author like decides to put it in there, like, The City of Bones is a perfect example, or The Immortal Instruments is. It has a great, great potential. And then there's a whole triangle romance that just doesn't need to be there. It doesn't. It really doesn't. Or it doesn't need to be, like, centered in every single book.
Interesting. So, are you into... like monster fiction and stuff like that?
Monster fiction?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
So there's, I love reading, so like in the Dresden Files, it introduces a lot of monsters that you already knew about, but they're different in this world. So like vampires in the Dresden Files, there's like multiple kinds of vampires, and then you kind of learn a little about the lore and stuff like that. So I love that stuff, like where you come in fresh and it's an idea. It's a thing you already know, but you have to relearn it in this very specific way. I love when books do that. And there was a series that was so fun to listen to called Monster Hunter International. You ever heard of that one?
Actually, yeah. I actually need to finish the last book. Larry Correa is an amazing author.
He's awesome. All right. So I haven't met too many other people that have read MHI, but I haven't read... I think I'm behind at least one book, maybe two. I haven't listened in so long.
What have you listened less?
Oh, man, I would have to Google it. I don't even remember. It's been years since I've listened to him, so there may be even more books. But I got my, I think he was 13 at the time. I got my 13-year-old to read a few of them, and he really liked it. Up until a point, he can only read so many, and then he gets bored, and then he wants to move on to something else, but...
MHI is great. I have way too much on my reading list, but I'm going to get around it at some point to finishing it. I think I only have one book left. It's Monster Hunter Siege.
Okay.
Because I think there's... I also read... I don't know if it's in English, but there's an author... There's a Russian author called Andrei Belyanin, and he also wrote... monster category fiction where essentially you have people from the future going back into the past and trying to negotiate with monsters not to hurt innocent bystanders. So their objective is not to kill the creature. Their objective is actually to rehabilitate it almost. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
Like I said, I don't know if it's in English, but if it is, it's called Werewolves. I thought it was really good, and I still do after reading it about 10 times. I think it's a 6-book series. Yeah.
And it's called Werewolves?
Werewolves, and there you begin.
All right, I'm making notes. All right, let's see, what else did I read? Stephen King's Dark Tower series. I've read that twice, and that was amazing. I actually got my... I've only got one kid that's like an avid reader, but he read through it and he flies through books. Like I read like a potato. I read so slow, like if I'm actually reading a book, but he just blasts through those things. maybe not quite as fast as you listen to stuff, but he goes through them pretty quick. And he finished Dark Tower. It took him, I don't know, like 4 months to get through the series. Maybe three.
Whoa.
Something like that.
Is it that long?
It is extremely long. I think it's like 7 books. Stephen King started writing it. So the very first book called The Gunslinger, he started writing that when he was in college. And then he finished the last book, I think, 10 years ago, something like that. So there was one book left on a cliffhanger, and he didn't write the next book for like 15 years. Which was
that's pulling R.R. Martin, man.
He did complete it. It was like, so he kind of got to this weird spot, and then at some point, so he lives out in like New Hampshire or Maine or something. I think he lives in Maine. Mm-hmm. And he was out for a walk and he got hit by a car, and he almost died or whatever. And after that, he was like, I've got to finish this book series. So then he pounded out the last books and just completed the series.
See, I couldn't read, like, I could have probably finished Shining quicker, but the problem was that at some point, your brain kind of gets overloaded. That's my problem with, like, SK, is that at some point you're just going to get tired, mentally worn out from his style of writing. And B, again, it hit too close to home, so there was only so much content I could parse it at a time.
I hear you. Yeah. It is an interesting novel.
You read Dr. Sleep, right?
I did.
And you said that it was better than the original?
Yeah, I thought it was better. I can't remember, because I read them like one right after the other. And mm-hmm. So I can't really remember, dude. So I used to commute a lot. So I live in College Station.
Archer.
And then I moved to Waco. So I grew up in Waco. I actually grew up in Hewitt, just south of Waco. But mm-hmm. So we moved down to College Station, lived and worked down here for a long time, then moved down to Waco, and then I was commuting back. Eventually, I came back to College Station. I don't know, whatever. But we decided we were going to move back home to have kids, and then realized, yeah, that's not a great idea. And then we came back. Anyway, I digress. Again, while I was doing that, I lived, I think, 100 miles away. So I was driving like 3.5 hours to 4 hours every day. So the only way I could stay sane, I found, was audiobooks. So I listened to so many audiobooks back in that time period. I did that for 1.5 years, and then for about 1 year, I did it every other day, and then I got out of that. But that got audiobooks kind of in me, and so I just kept going with them. And again, until I found podcasts, I found the thing that interested me most was podcasts that have some element of psychology in there, because people are the thing that I understand the least. Which interests me the most. So I just kind of found podcasts that sort of, well, that and comedy podcasts, a lot of those too. And I have kind of a messed up sense of humor, so they're not generally good for humans. But.
So is that why you enjoy like podcasts, is because of that human interaction that you don't really get with books? Or because I tried several podcasts and I was like, eh.
I had to try a lot before I started finding the ones that really kind of resonated with me. It took time, because I hit one that there was a kind of a nugget of something that really struck a chord with me. So I don't know, you're way too young to get it, but at some point in your life you realize that you actually can fundamentally change parts about your personality through like learning and stuff like that. And so I'm a technical guy, you're a technical guy forever. I always did technical certification, right? Like I've had like a Cisco certified network professional and network associate. I've had that since 2003. So I've had it forever and I've maintained it over and over, right? And so I was used to, hey, here's a new concept. Let me get a book and study it, learn it, master it. But I never realized I could do the same thing with myself. Right. And so once I learned that stuff, it really fascinated me. So I started trying to find more materials that sort of surrounded that. And Podcasts seem to speak more to that because it's kind of a living, breathing insight into some person's brain. I don't know.
Interesting.
I don't know. I think everybody gets something different out of it. You know what's funny is I used to listen to audiobooks so much that sometimes I would get home from work and I would start to tell my wife about this story, about this thing that happened today. And halfway into it, I'd realize, wait a minute, that was in my book. That didn't actually happen in real life.
You start to mix realities?
Yeah, because like with audiobooks, the characters, like when it's a good narrator, the characters are so real that they almost become part of your life. Especially like if you're reading like The Dark Tower, where it took me forever to get through that. Even with that long drive, it still took me forever. You know, they become part of your life almost, and it's super weird. And I found with some podcasts, I know the people on the podcast so well that they're like my friends, which is bizarre. And like this podcast, I've met people in real life that have been listening to it for years before they meet me, and they are just immediately comfortable and they start a conversation, and they don't realize that while they know me very well, I don't have a clue who they are. You know what I mean? So it's it's sort of strange and stilted. So that's convinced me I never want to meet any of the podcasters I listen to because it would just be too weird. But
I mean, it wouldn't be too weird for you. It would be too weird for them.
I know. You got to think they get accustomed to that, though, right? They get used to it at some point. I don't know.
I think that it's different every time. Like, it's the same case with the actors and narrators and stuff like that. People feel like they know them very well, and narrators are like, who are you?
I know. Well, but see, but then again, like actors, they're playing a part. The character they're playing is probably not even close to who they really are, you know? Whereas podcasters, I think a lot of them really are close to their true selves.
So then we have even more layer of awkwardness because people treat the actors as if they were that character.
Oh, like, dude, that's got to be the worst.
Personality. Yeah. So it's almost even worse than that. I didn't even think of that.
Oh, yeah. Like when people see actors in public, a lot of times they'll call them by their character's name. You know?
Oh, yeah. You should look up some GOT actors in public scenes. It's pretty funny.
Dude, I hate that cringe stuff. Oh, it makes me feel terrible. You know what's ironic, though, is my reaction, my wife loves that. So she likes watching cringy shows, not for the show itself, but for what it does to me. She enjoys that tremendously. So bizarre.
I mean, it could be a form of payback, I suppose.
I think it's a form of schadenfreude. I think she just enjoys deriving pleasures from other people's pain. She's also a fitness instructor, and she always says how much fun the classes are. And it is torture. I was like, I don't think you are using that word right. It's but you know what's funny is, so she teaches up at the gym all the time, or did until the Rona came along and locked everything down. And so now she's in the garage just working out with me. She's still doing her same workouts, but she's doing it with me. I agreed to do them with her, right? So that, you know, she'd have some semblance of normalcy, I guess, or whatever. And she says, man, it sucks in the garage. I was like, why? I was like, same workout. She goes, yeah, I don't know, man. It's like, if I'm not like teaching the class, it like really sucks. I was like, oh, now you realize what everyone else feels like. Yeah, get a little taste of it. So I don't know. I guess there's something about being in front of a group of people and performing that makes it different for her.
Social appreciation.
Yeah, I mean, I bet you she gets kind of like a little adrenaline rush, a little dopamine spike from it or something like that, right? That makes it not feel so crappy. Because I feel it every time I do stuff with her. It's crappy. There's no compromise.
There's no fun.
No, dude, it's awful.
There's a compromise.
She goes, can't you tell that you're getting stronger? And I was like, not really. It just, everything hurts all the time. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, after it hurts, it usually gets better. Usually.
Yeah, you'd think so, but she doesn't like, she's relentless. So it's like, as soon as you get to some level of comfort, she just adds weight or makes you do shit. You know, so it's like, there's no happy medium. You know what's crazy is I used to cycle. So I would cycle Mondays and Wednesdays, and then I would play this stupid game called pickleball. It's not stupid. It's actually amazing. But mm-hmm. I would do that like kind of a couple of times a week as well. And so I would mm-hmm. I would have like the cycle sucks because I would feel, you know, I push myself really hard because I have like a lot of anxiety and stuff like that. And hard cardio actually levels me out, like it evens me out. So I don't, you know, I, mm-hmm. I can survive. And I haven't been having that. So I used to hard cardio and I'm still doing hard cardio, but then I would have a break where I'd play a fun game the next day. And now it's like hard cardio and then lifting weights, which I don't want to do. It's miserable. And then it's hard cardio and this lift. And it's been giving me anxiety, like the thing that used to relieve anxiety, because it's like, God, there's no break. It's just one awful thing to the next. I think I need to, I gotta like put some skip days in there or something. It's killing me.
Yeah. I started biking recently. It's been okay. I just get bored if I do it for too long of a time because you just spin the pedals. That's all you do.
Well, see, like when I used to run, which I'm an old man and I'm falling apart, so I can't do it anymore. But that's when I would listen to audiobooks, and I liked it because it would turn my brain off and my body, like the worst parts of the exercise would just kind of go away because, you know, like my brain was engaged.
Yeah. I can't figure out if it's like you'll get used to the pain or it does eventually stop hurting.
I think you kind of find a happy medium. At some point, you know, your body will grow accustomed to it. It really will. And then you can choose to. I had gotten to a point where, like when I was running, where I wouldn't push myself. I would do the exact same thing every time I would go out, and I would get everything I needed and nothing more. And I would just, you know what I mean? It's like that allowed me the maximum ability to turn my brain off and not think, and still get what I needed out of it. So,
yeah.
I don't know. Everybody's different though, right?
Yeah.
So that's is that your only form of exercise now that you're trapped in the house all the time?
Biking? I mean, pretty much. We sometimes go on walks, but that's rare. But yeah, biking is the only form of exercise. I need to find some good workouts for the rest of my body.
Gotcha.
I've also been... not really an exercise, but something else to distract. You asked me quite a bit ago what I was doing. Besides C++ and stuff to mentally stimulate me. And I am a percussionist. I play drum set. So I've been working on a song for the past 2 weeks. It's pretty interesting. I'm in marching band. We actually have a drum set and a marching band, so there's no need for me to march. And I'm also in jazz band, but band is kind of on the back burner right now because, you know, COVID.
Yeah. So are you a senior in high school?
No, I'm a sophomore.
Okay. Sophomore in high school. And mm-hmm. you guys have a marching band.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to Midway or no? Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You Midway. Are in Midway. Okay.
Midway High.
That's where I went.
Oh.
I have no school pride. I don't really care one way or the other where anybody goes. I sort of know the area.
As long as I get education, I don't care. As long as I get quality education, yeah. I don't care where I get it.
Yeah. My wife went to a city north of Waco called Axtell. She graduated in a class of like 15. And mm-hmm. their version of education was very different than Midway's version of education. So,
in a good way?
No. Like, she was the basketball star. So, sometimes in class, she would say, I'm just going to go shoot in the gym. The teachers would say, okay. So, she would just... it's very interesting. Interesting version of high school. So yeah. I thought Midway was good education, and I feel like the schools here are equivalent, if not better. So all that stuff's important. I don't know, man. Finding that balance. My kids always want to say, "I'm not going to use this stuff," like whatever class they happen to be. Then I'm not going to use this ever when I grow up. Is that how you feel, or do you feel like all of it's useful?
I mean, I do feel like a lot of it, like chemistry. I'm taking chemistry right now. Okay, I'm gonna use some of the stuff, but 99% of it I'm not gonna use. Like, I'm gonna use fractions as I continue higher in math. I'm gonna
for sure
use like algebraic expressions, but I'm not gonna use acids and knowing how to what's the word?
Neutralize it.
Electrolysis. How they go for electrolysis and like what happens to their chemical equations. I'm not gonna use that. Or like geometry. I'm not. Yeah, geometry. It's a loaded subject. Let's just say that a lot of it, I think, is not applicable to me. Like 3D shapes and area and volume. Like, it's good to know that, but I can look up the formulas on Google. Or something like that, or like writing proofs. I'm not gonna.
You know, it's you're kind of a contradiction there of cultures and things for me. So I think about how nowadays we have so much technology, so that phone in your hand can quite literally give you any formula to any math problem you'll ever require. Mm-hmm. Right? You can look up anything, so you really don't have the need to memorize anything. And yet you said it's very important to you to code in Notepad. That way you're forced to memorize everything. So you're a bit of a contradiction there.
I mean, it's true, but I don't have, like, I don't consciously memorize Notepad. I have pretty much a new tab in Google open every time I sit down to code, whether it's for C++ or Python. And partially it's because I don't remember how to do X, Y, and Z. I mean, you can, if you go through my search history, you'll probably find, in fact, I'll guarantee you find duplicates of the same question, precisely because I don't remember stuff.
Right, right.
But like, I can't think of a good. I mean, what would you memorize? Like, why would you memorize a formula if you can look it up? You know what I mean?
You know, it's a bit of irony because right now you're wearing an Albert Einstein T-shirt, and there's a quote that I've always I remembered that was attributed to him. I don't know how true it is or not, but they were saying that the one time he was being interviewed by a reporter back in the day, and I can't remember whether the reporter had a meeting coming up or Einstein did, but one of them had to leave. And the reporter said, hey, just give me your phone number and I'll call you and we can finish it later. And he goes, sure. And so then Einstein pulls out the phone book and looks up his phone number and gives it to the guy. And the guy says, you don't even remember your own number. He goes, why would I do that when I have a resource that's right here that does it for me?
Yeah. Fun fact, I don't remember my phone number. I really don't.
I know my phone number, and I know my wife's phone number, and I know zero other phone numbers.
Yeah, I try memorizing that, and that's... That and colors are the only things that doesn't stick in my brain. So that, yeah, I'm sorry about the noise.
No, man, it's all good. The listeners could suck it up. I'll listen to the inside of your house for a minute.
Wow.
You know, something interesting that you mentioned color. Something interesting that I heard a long time ago, and that I've subsequently asked my kids is, I heard was, hey, if you had to, how would you describe the color yellow to a blind person? Like somebody who's born without sight and has never seen it. How would you describe that? Have people like, How do you reconcile that in your head? The only thing I could come up with was to convey the emotions that makes me feel when I think of these colors.
Right, but those are valid questions, and those are the questions that I can't really answer. Because what do you think I see?
I just assume nothing.
You're the first person that doesn't say black.
Okay.
Because you're right, nothing is what I see. Nothing as in, not. I can't use void, because apparently that implies blackness. But imagine, like, can you see air?
No, absolutely not.
So if that helps relate, that's that's what I see. I see air, which means that I see nothing. It's not black because I don't know what black is. Yeah. And relating colors to feelings doesn't really work because people don't really feel exactly the same thing with each color. No. And so I can't really form or I can't really like form a database, if you will, of like, okay, red means angry or something like that. Also, I don't have a knowledge of colors contrasting and complementing with each other. Like, I don't know what colors go with each other. I don't know what colors mix well, what colors don't.
Yeah, that's easy. Just wear blue jeans. Then you never have to think about it.
Well, I just wear shorts and a t-shirt have to, 99% of the time.
There you go. Because as I say, blue jeans go with everything. You don't have to think.
No, but I genuinely, like, I would like to get into writing. Like, writing stories, fanfics. Because I actually would be interested in doing that. But the problem is that something is like stopping me, and I believe that the inability to give the description, like I will try to mimic some authors that I have read, at least in their, like, in the amount of descriptions that they give, and I really can't because a lot of it is so visual. Actually, few books include emotional picture unless it's absolutely necessary to the plot. So it's been very difficult to write.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. But I don't know, that's a unique perspective. Instead of going down the same worn down path that everybody else has gone down, where it falls into this familiar rhythm and I know this thing, it could be very different and fresh. I mean, and that's like in a lot of media and art, that's what people thirst for, right? It's something that's just different, something that's not the same old, same old. So maybe it you could have that be, voice.
But I mean, like, I see where you're coming from, but I also want to have the ability to include it. Maybe I will not include it all the time, but like as a literary device or as a, you know, a plot hook or a character hook, as a, it's like sort of a background detail that comes into the scene or into the plot later on or something like that. I can't really do that. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
So like, I would like to have the chance or the ability to include it on the off chance that I may decide to use it. Maybe I'll like, I will never be able to use it direct. Like, I will never be able to accurately describe how something looks.
I don't even, like, that's interesting. Because that's such an interesting thought puzzle. Is how do you do that without describing the way things appear? And how mm-hmm. much, so if I listened to my favorite audiobook and they had like no descriptions of appearance, maybe just the way something is textured. Yeah, as you say, if maybe it's just a description of the way it's textured or the way it feels or the emotion it elicits, I wonder how different that experience would be. And that's fascinating to think about.
I think that sometimes describing textures is appropriate. But sometimes, like, you just need those, or people need those images. Otherwise, they're just gonna. It's kind of what I said of Stephen King earlier. There's only so much content they can parse on that level. And I think since the texture is so different and it forces people to go out of their comfort zone, eventually, like, they'll get tired of it, or not tired necessarily, but their brains will, like, just short circuit. And, like, the entire book will be considered poor in their eyes precisely because there's just so much of different experiences. But then again, there are others who, like you said, yearn for this kind of thing. So it's, well, I don't know, it's a coin toss.
And I was thinking too, you adjusted to all these books that are describing things the way they look.
But I didn't have to. Like, for me, colors are there. but I never, like, we were at the Book Thief in English. Book Thief has a lot of imagery and a lot of colors. So when I read colors and image, like when I read that stuff, for me, a lot of the times they're just words, and I move past them because I can't really get the picture,
right.
And I can't really, like, if an author tries to make a color mean something, I will not pick that up.
Now, you and me both. That stuff, I think, is a lot of times lost on me. So, the things that draw me in the most are people's personality. Like, I like books that are like character studies, more based on the person, their eccentricities, and the way they talk, the way they feel and think. That's the stuff that is the most interesting to me, right? So, but then again, I may be abnormal I think I'm abnormal when it comes to that. So,
you should have you read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich?
No, I haven't.
It's a study of how, or like Germany's, it's basically a point of view of Germany from the First World War through the Second one. And it studies the people behind it, the conversations that happened behind it, the documents, the phone calls that were behind, orchestrating World War II. It's pretty interesting.
It is. So we were talking about Stephen King earlier, and if you were looking for one that was just a light, like not... like a diet Stephen King book. He did one, I think about 6 or 7 years ago, called Joyride. And it kind of follows this kid in New England, like in the late 70s, at a theme park. And so it's basically just a character study of carnies, like all the weird people that work in, like, that work at the fair and stuff like that. And so it's just kind of like it picks up on some of their jargon and just... kind of, it just sort of weaves their personalities around, and then there's a little bit of like eerie, weird stuff right at the very end, like at the very end, because he realized he almost finished the book and hadn't put anything strange in there, so he had to shoehorn it in right at the end. But I really like, sometimes I just like character studies, like books that are just weird, interesting character stuff, like not a lot of stuff has to necessarily be happening or going on. So, I don't know. Very abnormal when it comes to that, I think, though.
I don't know. Like you said, I think it's pretty unique. And I don't think that's necessarily bad. In fact, I'll probably check out Joyride, or at least add it to my ever-growing collection.
Yeah. But I think, too, with a lot of stuff, just like in life, you just have to start. Just do it. You know that you're going to suck at it at first, but then you'll get better, right?
Yeah.
So, I would be very curious.
To what?
To see where you went with it. Like, just, like, the idea of writing all based on touch and feel, I don't even think I would notice, like, the lack of... descriptions of colors, or maybe the expressions on people's faces. Like, I think I don't even think I would notice that stuff wasn't there.
See, I think, like, the expressions you could probably do, because they're, like, generalized, that you could generalize an expression, or you could say that, like, an expression of shock always has these characteristics.
Yeah.
And then you can, like, add something to make it a little more, like, quirky. But colors are ever shifting, ever changing, and really, their society defines them, whereas expressions are much more out of societal control.
Yeah, and I think in writing, at least whenever I think of colors and stuff, when people are describing places or scenarios, it's really just to spark your imagination, right, and kind of get you to start visualizing that stuff in your head, which is interesting, because that's not a thing for you. You must, like, whenever you use your imagination, you're just, like, I'm trying to figure out what you're building in your head.
I mean, I have an image. It's just colorless. I mean, that's what it is. I still imagine stuff. I can imagine myself being somewhere.
Yeah, because you know those things. So, yeah, that makes sense.
But just the senses that are going to accompany that are going to be... senses, not like sight. I'm not gonna picture me seeing this or that. it's more, like you said, it's more going to be like texture, feel, smell, hearing.
Yeah. I had kind of a weird childhood. So I learned to suppress a lot of things. So I like learned to basically suppress the way I feel about everything for most of my life. And so I'm just now, this is why this stuff interests me so much, is I'm just now learning to feel my feelings and stuff like that. And so a lot of it's new to me. So it just, it fascinates me. Like, for one, how I could go so long and not do those things. But just how it, part of it is me learning how other people process the world, and it helps me process the world. So a lot of this stuff is truly fascinating to me. It really is, because I very much a lot of times feel like I'm somebody watching a movie trying to figure out what's going on there, you know, like outsider on the outside.
Yeah. Social customs are certainly interesting.
Yeah, for sure, man. Oh, that's wacky wild, dude. Well, do you have like an online presence or anything like that? Do you have like a website that you maintain? What do you do?
I mean, I have a GitHub account.
All right, baller.
That's the only thing like noticeable about me. And once you set up a website, in fact, I started on it, but it would probably be more of a blog than anything when I get it together.
That's awesome.
But my major accomplishments are our GitHub account. That's where I will post my stuff or post my open source projects. And I have stuff on there. Or I have, like, I've contributed to some places. Not a lot. I still need to expand that. And I still need to upload stuff for C++, because right now there's only Python in there. But other than that.
That's awesome. I definitely, man, I think, I feel ashamed. I only started a GitHub account, like, 2 months ago. But I've had a blog for, like, 8 to 10 years, somewhere around there. And I definitely encourage people to do that. I think one is it's a living resume. Right, an employer can look at everything you've done and just quickly scroll through and see all that stuff. So I definitely think that's a plus, especially somebody as young as you start a blog. I think that's baller.
Yeah, I just need to find a good website. I don't really like WordPress. The way they have stuff is a little funky and weird. So I'll look into it though.
For sure, man.
I'll continue to.
All right, dude. Well, you need to send me your GitHub stuff, your GitHub info, and then I'll post that up as a link in the release. But we are at an hour and about 15 minutes, man. So I say we stick a fork in it, because I don't want to eat up any more of your morning. I hear my family starting to root around, and they are really loud. You think your family's loud? So, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still there. It's a little crackling.
No worries. All right, so let's put a fork in it.
Thank you,
Oleg. Thank you so much for coming on here. Anytime you have anything to contribute, I would love for you to fire information over there. Everybody listening, you said you heard him himself. If you want to get a hold of him, do you want people to get a hold of you through GitHub or what? What's the story there? If you want them to, you don't necessarily have to.
I'll send my email information as well if people want to send me messages or something like that. I have a Twitter account, but it's a long story, shorthand. I'm not really on Twitter anymore.
All right, fair enough.
I didn't get locked out of it or anything. I just kind of lost passion for it.
I never got on the Twitter bandwagon. That one sort of sailed right past me, and it's definitely too late to get on there now. That's not my bag.
Yeah,
I'm more into talking to people now. So if you want to get a hold of me, it's the same old way. It's greg@gregsoul.com. You can go to gregsoul.com, where I very occasionally blog on technical stuff. You can find us at thebrotherswisp.com for the podcast stuff. Questions, comments, fire them away. If you guys are desperately in need of some more Oleg, I will pass your information over there, and you guys can maybe have a dialogue. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Oleg. I really appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday
morning.
Thank you.
And I appreciate it.
We'll talk to everybody
else. It was very interesting.
All right, man.